from KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, it's been a very tough week in presidential campaign politics, from new allegations of sexual assault levied at Donald Trump to revelations about Hillary Clinton after another WikiLeaks email release. But who better to help us make sense of it all than New York Times columnist Maureen Dowd? With her trademark acerbic wit, she's covered both Trump and Clinton since the 90s and nine presidential elections. Her new book, The Year of Voting Dangerously, explores both the drama and dysfunction of the 2016 presidential election. Join us for a conversation with Maureen Dowd next on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, welcome to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. The number of women accusing Donald Trump of sexual assault continues to grow. More fallout after a 2005 videotape where the Republican presidential nominee can be heard bragging about groping women. Trump has said he'd soon release evidence proving several allegations are not true. Hillary Clinton has kept a fairly low profile to keep the focus on Trump, but the events of this week are yet another stark reminder that we're in the midst of one of the nastiest presidential elections in recent memory. America got mad and went mad, writes my guest, New York Times columnist Maureen Dowd, in her new book, The Year of Voting Dangerously. It pulls together her columns about the turbulent 2016 election and past campaigns. Dowd has covered nine presidential elections and has been writing about Donald Trump since the 90s. She's famously critical of Hillary Clinton as well. She won a Pulitzer Prize for her series of columns on the Monica Lewinsky scandal in the Clinton administration. Welcome to Forum, Maureen Dowd.
Thank you, Mina.
And congratulations on the book.
Thank you.
So I said that the number of women accusing the Republican presidential nominee of sexual assault continues to grow. Do you know where it stands right now? It feels like every minute it changes.
Well, when I was watching TV in my hotel room, there were more women overnight and an announcement that there would be more women this afternoon. So, but, you know, I was thinking about it. It's funny because Trump's whole campaign has been less about issues and ideology than what I call ego arithmetic. So when in the book, I talk about when I first interviewed him on his first presidential foray in 99. And I asked him, why do you think people would vote for you for president? And he said, well, because I got high ratings on Larry King and because a lot of men hit on Melania, who he was dating then. So it was all about the numbers that he accrued. And you see that through this whole campaign, you know, the polls, the numbers, the ratings, that's how he answers any serious question about substance. So now the irony is he's going to be brought down by this other number that we're watching, which is going up exponentially.
Right. And the numbers are not moving in his
favor. Right. The number of women who have these seamy stories.
Right. And we also have the situation now where, unbelievably, it feels like this presidential election is turning even nastier and darker than it was, you know, before the debates. I mean,
I think that Donald Trump will kind of disappear like a fiery orange comet, you know, hitting the ocean after this. I don't think he's really going to be part of our public discourse. I think there's going to be mass revulsion.
So you've already written him off. He will lose this election, I mean.
Oh, yeah, I have, yeah.
Wow. You have talked about...
I think, you know, when I covered Mitt Romney, it always seemed to me he was running for president of white male America. And he won that. He's president of white male America. And Donald Trump, the same. He's running, you know, as president of angry white male America. And I don't think you can't, even months ago, before all the recent cascade of troubles, he had 94% disapproval rate with African Americans. You know, I mean, practically the only African American who supports him is Dr. Ben Carson. He had a 74% disapproval rate with women, and that was over the summer. And I asked him about that. I said, how could you possibly win the presidency with that? And he paused and he goes, 68%. Because again, the ego arithmetic, he had a different poll that had a slightly lower number. And I said, okay, well, you can't win if 68% of women are appalled by you.
You've talked about covering Trump initially you said covering Trump is wicked fun, right, in your book. And you talked about how the most enjoyable thing about covering the Trump phenomenon is watching him make, quote, monkeys out of a lot of people who had it coming. I'm curious if you still feel like it's wicked fun.
Oh, no, that didn't last very long. But in that same column, I said, I talked about the things that were wicked fun, which I'll talk about. And then in the second half of the column, the things that were just wicked. So the only thing that was fun at the very beginning was to see the golden political apple cart of sort of political leeches and hacks overturned, that Jeb Bush spent $170 million in negative ads. And, you know, that wasn't necessary, that you didn't have to give millions and millions of dollars to consultants to give you bad advice, or $170 million to smear your opponents. So it was kind of fun to see someone do it on their own without all the, you know, the creepy dark money and all that stuff. And also...
Well, do you think talking about it is what made some folks see you as being somewhat sympathetic to Trump and his candidacy?
No, I think it was the fact that I was doing interviews with him for
just
a while.
Talking to him at all?
At all.
I mean, getting some pushback on that.
Yeah, even from my own friends. I mean, my friends did not want to read interviews with Donald Trump. My theory is that I would rather hear what someone is thinking. He was the Republican nominee, or heading to be the Republican nominee. I'd rather hear what he's thinking if he would talk to me, rather than just censor him. And also, but I think a lot of people think this election is so important and Donald Trump is so dangerous that we should just give Hillary a free pass and then, you know, not allow Donald Trump to talk. But I think my theory all along, which is proven right, is that if you let someone implode, they're going to implode. I mean, he was always imploding from the very beginning.
We're talking with longtime New York Times columnist Maureen Dowd about this 2016 presidential election and about her new book, The Year of Voting Dangerously, which is a collection of her columns and also some new work related to interviews and other things that she's done that have not been on her New York Times page. You've interviewed Donald Trump since the 90s. Mm-hmm. Is the Donald Trump we're seeing now the same Donald Trump you interviewed then?
No, he was a different character in New York, a little buffoonish, you know, cartoonish, but not the angry, violent, crazy person. And even, you know, I think Hillary and Bill Clinton, who had been friendly with him, had not seen that person that showed up on the campaign trail.
Right. There are images, and, of course,
yeah,
of them at Donald Trump and Melania's wedding.
But I think that surprised them, too, that he could be so dark and nasty. But I think that I asked him about this early on. And I said, the person I see on the campaign trail, these bursts of bigotry, is not who you seem to be. I mean, I didn't know him well. I just interviewed him a few times over the years. But his persona was not this vicious, nasty, bigoted person. I said, why do you seem so different? And he said, well, I guess I went to number one. Again, the ego arithmetic. I went to number one with the crowd saying this kind of thing. And I guess I just thought I had to keep doing it. So basically, he just got, you know, on a journey to some really dark, scary places. He was following the roar of the crowd. In a way, it's like when you see those old clips of him with Howard Stern, he's trying to win the moment. So he's trying to be a chauvinist pig with Howard Stern to win the ratings, win the moment with Howard Stern. And it's the same when he got to be president. So he heard the roar of the crowd for the bigoted things, and he just kept going in that direction, thinking that he could change back later, that it was an opening negotiating bid, or that people knew he was someone else. But as you know, you become who you are at the microphone. So if little Muslim girls are getting taunted, or Latino students are getting taunted, or Muslim women are getting beat up, or, you know, reporters are getting roughed up at his rallies, he's responsible for that because of what he said at the microphone.
But if he was a, quote, caveman, as you've described him in the way he talked about women and his views on the Howard Stern show, for example, do you think that it's talk and that he's not capable of the assaults that women are accusing him of?
I wasn't sure, you know, I wasn't sure if the when the Billy Bush tape came out, if that was mostly braggadocio, you know, again, because it wasn't quite consistent with the image in New York, which again was like a Batman character or a cartoon. You know, he was like a big cardboard cutout at various parties around New York, but he wasn't seen as a predator. But now that all this other stuff has come out, it's sort of amazing that he didn't realize it would come out, that he's created this alternative universe called Trump World, where he thinks he can just create a different reality.
It's very interesting, though, how you said that he has no real ideology other than the ideology of winning. And so how did he adopt such a strong ideological position on so many things?
Well, it's also because of the roar of the crowd. You know, it's also the ideology of ego. For instance, so Vladimir Putin gives him a compliment, right, and he completely changes the Republican Party's historical stance and orthodoxy on the evil empire. They have a very wary stance. And then he gets this compliment and he's like a little kid in the schoolyard. He's like, no, this guy's my friend now. We love Russia. You know, and the Republican Party officials are left to twist and turn and try and reconcile their nominees' opinion with the historical stance of the party. And it's all because he got a compliment. And Stephen Lee Myers, a reporter in the Washington Bureau of the Times, who wrote a wonderful Putin biography, says the whole thing is absurd because Putin's word was mistranslated. He did not say brilliant. The word means gaudy.
Wow.
So Putin said that Trump was flashy or gaudy. No, he doesn't know it. So he's changed the entire stance of the Republican Party for a mistranslation.
And if, as you say, his whole brand is built on winning, and if, as you've earlier said, that he's done essentially in terms of his getting the presidency, right? What happens to his brand after this?
Well, I think this is a really fascinating question, and I've been interviewing a lot of brand experts like Donnie Deutsch and friends. He doesn't have that many friends, but what friends he has in New York about it. And I think that he and Ivanka are in denial. I think that Ivanka is just coming out of denial now about what has happened, what is going to happen to their brand. I think their brand is destroyed because it's not, except for the Post Office Hotel in Washington, he's a licensee or licensor or whatever you call it. He just gives his name. So I went over to his hotel in Washington the other day to see. I had heard they cut the rooms in half, the price of the rooms, and then it was empty. So it was kind of empty. And there was a African-American family standing under the Trump name outside having their picture taken. I'm thinking, So I walk around and they were all thumbs down under the Trump sign. And you know, there was vandalism. There was yellow police tape up because someone had written Black Lives Matter. And it was empty inside. And I just think that, again, Trump did not think out the consequences when he went to these dark places of what that would mean for his brand. And I think Ivanka, I'm sure, is distraught because her whole life as she knew it, where she was friends with Michael Bloomberg
and even Chelsea Clinton.
And friends with Chelsea Clinton, I think, is gone. And everybody thinks when they get back to New York, they'll be pariahs and his brand is completely ruined. So, in the end, he may have to do that TV company with Roger Ailes and these guys because they'll have nowhere else to go.
So the hotel is like a metaphor, among other things.
Yes.
But then will there not be, say, you know, Republicans coming along later, up-and-coming Republicans who will then adopt? There's been concern that there's going to be this thing called Trumpism, right, where you'll adopt some aspects of Trump's message because you saw it had such appeal among a substantive enough segment of the population of the U.S., right, that you would incorporate it into your platforms.
Yeah, I know.
You don't think that's going to happen?
Well, I can turn out to be completely wrong. But to me, these voters, these angry voters, and some of them are sexist and racist, which has been stirred up by the election of the first African-American president and the first woman running. And some of them are angry for legitimate reasons. We went into this misbegotten forever war. The economy almost turned over. No one acknowledged that globalization wasn't the bright, shiny, perfect object that it was supposed to be. So there's legitimate anger. But those voters were there before Trump, and they'll be there after Trump.
We're talking with Maureen Dowd, Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist for The New York Times. She's the author of The Year of Voting Dangerously. And her other books include Bush World, Enter at Your Own Risk, and Are Men Necessary? The WikiLeaks email dumps that have been happening, I think we have the fourth installment this week. What do you make of them? Do you think there's been the way that it's been characterized, I think, in the media generally, right, unless you're Fox News, is that they're not as damning as it seemed they would be. And there are allegations of whether or not it's appropriate, right, to be reporting on, or questions about whether or not it's appropriate to be reporting on emails that could have been the result of a Russian hack or Russian influence in the presidential election. Do you think that these emails, A, do you think they're very damaging to Hillary Clinton if they're given the coverage that Donald Trump, say, has gotten, comparatively speaking? Or do you think that, it's just the nature of this election that this would be a huge story if it weren't for Trump?
That is a great question. I mean, I was struck with the Billy Bush tape that absolutely no kind of pause was given to the fact that Trump didn't realize he was being taped. So I think that kind of privacy in this country is over. People don't, I had a couple emails to Amy Pascal, the head of Sony, because she's a friend of mine that came out in the Sony hack, and they had nothing to do with Sony business. It was about mutual friends of ours. And, there was not a pause or hesitation about printing it, the idea that it was a private email. And I feel the same. No one has any compunction about pawing through Hillary's, staff's email. But on the second part of the question, I agree with you, because so far what we have learned about Hillary is just a confirmation of what we already knew. So John Podesta and Jennifer Palmieri, who are helping run the campaign, keep complaining to Hillary's inner circle that she should be more forthright about the email scandal, that she should get on top of it and handle it. And she's very defensive and secretive. So we already knew that. John Podesta complains that Sidney Blumenthal, Hillary's henchman, who was kind of helping smear Monica, that he wouldn't want to be like him. He says, shoot me if I'm ever like him. Well, we already know what Hillary and Sidney Blumenthal's relationship is. He was also spreading the birther thing. A rare case where Trump is right. And
so that is true.
Yeah.
Except for the fact that so you're saying the accusations are true that he was initially spreading the birther thing, but the fact that Hillary Clinton didn't go with it?
To a McClatchy reporter said, Sidney Blumenthal went and said, why didn't you send a reporter to Kenya and see if Obama was born there? And other reporters were called by people around Hillary. So I don't know. Hillary didn't use it in her campaign, but whatever. So we haven't learned anything. And then I guess they brought up in the latest batch today or whatever, Bill's, the alleged Bill girlfriend in Chappaqua. And there was a National Enquirer story they were discussing how to deal with. So I just don't think there's anything there yet. I know Julian Assange, one of the many bizarre things, Russian hackers, white supremacists, Julian Assange hidden in a women's bathroom in Ecuador saying he's going to destroy Hillary Clinton. I mean, the whole thing is just crazier than the plot of any Padachevsky movie you could imagine,
Well, you've been famously described as hating Hillary Clinton. I think the Guardian that wrote about you recently when it was talking about your book put it that way. Do you think that's a fair characterization of how you feel about her?
No, I don't. I mean, I just don't feel any kind of personal animus toward politicians. I don't want to be their friend. I don't want to have dinner with them. I don't want to go drinking with them. I also don't feel... those kind of strong emotions are not how I feel about politicians. I feel, it's corny to say, but I feel like we're in a system of checks and balances. And the Clintons do a lot of things that need scrutiny, unfortunately. And so if you want to be the most powerful person in the world, you've got to have scrutiny. And that doesn't mean you can't completely scrutinize Donald Trump having a historic, crazy meltdown. But I think it would do her a disservice and us and democracy if we didn't also scrutinize her.
Well, speaking of scrutinizing her, do you think it's problematic that, assuming the WikiLeaks emails are accurate, that she portrayed herself to bankers as more supportive of free trade, more flexible on industry regulation than she has during her drive for the presidency?
Well, again, nothing we didn't know. I don't think Bernie Sanders and his supporters believed her when she modified her position on trade. So I'm sure, you know, they're angry, but they shouldn't be surprised. That's, you know, the Clintons have a long history of protecting their viability, which is what she did when she made the disastrous vote to help W go to war in Iraq, and actually went down to the floor of the Senate and went farther than any other senator and helped him make the fake link between Al-Qaeda and Saddam. And at the time, Bill Clinton said, it's better to be strong and wrong than weak and right. And his advisors told her that as the first woman, she had to be on the side of that war. So I guess the Hillary that, you know, more idealistic voters want to see is the one who, you know, takes a stand, and not for her political viability, but like in Beijing, which is an old clip. But that's the Hillary that would be bracing to see.
The one who's devoted her life to public service.
Right.
Because you have covered her since the early 90s, right? How has she changed? I mean, you're saying that she's actually quite consistent. These emails are really showing very similar things, right, about her, what we may already know.
Right.
Has she changed a lot from the time that you met her initially?
Well, it's interesting because when I went back at the beginning of the stories in the book, I was a news reporter. So I was covering her as the wife of the candidate, Bill Clinton's wife. And, you know, my stories are so supportive, even as a news reporter, that various interviewers have asked me if I had a girl crush on her because I felt really strongly that, you know, as with Michelle, Hillary had the same educational credentials and some of the same accomplishments as her husband, and yet she had to go into this antiquated little white satin box we call the First Lady. And, you know, it's just hard for women. And during that campaign in 92, she got a box of stationery, and they had left out Rodham. It was just Hillary Clinton. They had left out her name, and she sent it back and was very upset. She chafed against it much more. Like, Michelle had a battle plan and perfectly completed it. But Hillary was constantly chafing. She hated the name First Lady. And so anyway, I was really sympathetic. And I was also dubious when she took over healthcare, which is 16% of the economy, because it's hard to tell the president's wife if she's doing something wrong. But she, you know, I said she was dazzling and everything. But then that secrecy defensive side of her kicked in, and it didn't work.
We're talking with Maureen Dowd, Pulitzer Prize winner and New York Times columnist, about the ongoing fallout from Trump's comments about grabbing and kissing women. And also we're discussing Clinton's emails released by WikiLeaks. Her new book is The Year of Voting Dangerously, which explores the drama and dysfunction of this 2016 presidential election. After the break, we'll take your calls and comments. Stay with us. This is Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're talking with Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist Maureen Dowd of the New York Times. She's the author of The Year of Voting Dangerously, which is about this 2016 election. Her other books include Bush World, Enter at Your Own Risk, and Are Men Necessary? Join the conversation with your questions or comments for Maureen Dowd at 866-733-6786. Again, that's 866-733-6786. You can also email your questions or comments to forum@kqed.org. Post them on our website, kqed.org/forum, where you can post them on Facebook or on Twitter. We're at KQED Forum. Let's see what our listeners have to say. A listener writes, Maureen Dowd was criticized in 2008 by the New York Times public editor Clark Hoyt, who said by assailing Clinton in gender-heavy terms, Dowd went over the top. If I could add to that, Frank writes, I have read Dowd's column for many years. I've never understood her seeming animosity to Hillary Clinton. What drives this animosity? If you think of Hillary within the context of politicians, she's very impressive. Do you want to respond to those comments? One about the New York Times public editor saying that you went over the top and concerns that you have animosity towards her.
Yeah, I didn't. I disagreed with our public editor. And, you know, I think that there's a tendency when a woman is writing about a woman to, you know, feel that she should be somehow more supportive of her. But Hillary wants to be the most powerful person in the world. And I treat her like every other politician I cover. And I think Hillary does have an amazing sort of idealistic public service side where she does want to do good works. Unfortunately, over the years, she has developed a very defensive and secretive side and my way or the highway. And she has a crew of creepy henchmen around her that Bernie Sanders used to complain to me about. And, you know, that side, the darker side where she makes decisions from a place of fear and insecurity, tends to trip up the lighter public service side.
What would be an example of that? What is there a moment that you feel like kind of defined her to you, and then and why has the narrative changed?
Yeah, really? You can see the arc of that from Whitewater to when she had pneumonia. So, you know, that has given her what David Axelrod calls an allergy to transparency. So with Whitewater, George Stephanopoulos has written that if he could get a genie in a bottle and change one thing about his years with the Clintons, it would be to persuade Hillary to give the Whitewater papers to the Washington Post. He said it would have been a one-week story. It wasn't that big of a deal. Everybody would have moved past it. But because Hillary wouldn't allow that, it snowballed. She gets in this pattern where the press and her foes think she's hiding something, and records disappear and appear, and, you know, they never feel they get a straight story. So it sends them into this frenzy. So Whitewater snowballed into 7 or 8 federal investigations. The taxpayers paid $80 million. It ended up in impeachment. You know, so these things kind of snowball. And then you had a microcosm of that with the pneumonia, where everyone thinks she has remarkable stamina. She didn't need to hide the pneumonia or, you know, kind of try and put off the press about it. And again, as David Axelrod said, it was the stealth, not the health. So, you know, if she could just pull out of this pattern of secretiveness and defensiveness, it would be better.
Well, let's go to Rhett in Port Jarvis, New York. Hi, Rhett.
Hello. Glad to get on with you. I've been listening to your comments, Ms. Dowd, and I really want to make the comment that my impression of Donald Trump and his ascendancy to where he is now, it took him as much by surprise as it took many others by surprise, and he ended up with a tiger by the tail, a super-duper hot potato that he didn't know what to do with, and that has set up an extremely easy finish for the Democrats in this election season, this campaign season. I'd like to hear your thoughts on that.
Right, thanks.
I'll listen off air. Thank you.
I think that is a brilliant summation of exactly what happened. Donald Trump was stunned to find himself, you know, succeeding as well as he did. And, you know, you could see it in his eyes in those Republican primary debates where he just kept thinking someone was going to pin him down on his lack of substance. And then instead, he got to throw out these Don Rickles insults and have what he refers to as a one-day kill with Jeb. And he, you know, he is just sort of, you're right, exactly. It's like the tiger by the tail. That is just a perfect distillation of what happened to him. It reminds me of like a bank robber who goes in the bank and is expecting all these locked doors and guards, and there was nothing there. There was nothing, you know. And I joke that my family Thanksgivings are difficult because all my siblings are very conservative and some of them are Trump voters. And but what is the Bush family Thanksgiving going to be like when Billy Bush gets home and the rest of the Bush family is like, you couldn't have given us that tape in February because they could have killed off Trump then. And he was bragging to everyone about the tape, at, you know, when he covered the Olympics, but he never told his family.
Well, some feel like folks had that tape for a long time and were being very strategic about when to release it at a time when the ballots had already been printed for Donald Trump. So maybe that was the more effective way to kill his candidacy if you were against
him. But not while Jeb Bush was in.
Except, yeah, you sacrificed Jeb Bush at that point. Well, thanks very much for the call, Rhett. And Sean writes, my observation is that the rise of right-wing labor populism is due to the fact that the left wing has decided to abandon economic justice for identity politics. The way to change this is for the left elites to stop playing minorities against whites. Why didn't folks see Donald Trump's rise coming, especially in the media? Is it because, does it have anything to do with what Sean is saying here?
I don't think they saw Bernie Sanders' rise coming. I mean, you know, I do feel sorry for Hillary Clinton when you look at her trajectory since 2008. So she comes in 2008 and she thinks she is the queen who is going to get, you know, have a coronation. And she didn't even talk to the press, you know, at the beginning of that campaign. And then this handsome young African-American prince rises from nowhere without much experience in the Senate. And she was just dumbfounded by this. And it becomes this incredible phenomenon. And he usurps her place. So then she comes back this time and is the queen and expects a coronation. And she's been the good soldier. And then this cranky 74-year-old loner in the Senate, who, again, doesn't have that much of a record, becomes a phenomenon and the chick magnet. He gets the young women voters that she assumed would be excited about her. And again, she's kind of like, what the heck? And then she gets in the general and gets this short-fingered vulgarian, you know, and who is just literally a crazy person melting down. And until a couple weeks ago, she's in a dead heat with him. So from her point of view, I'm sure she goes home at night, you know, and has a glass of wine and thinks, what the hell is going on here?
And it sounds like you have ready-made advice for her on how to deal with that. Let's go to more calls. And again, that number is 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Renee in Fremont. Hi, Renee.
Hi, I'm here.
Go ahead.
Well, first of all, I'm just really thrilled to be able to talk to you, Maureen, because I read your column every Sunday, and I love my New York Times and specifically your comments. So I'm interested to see what you think about the post-election, if Trump will continue with his challenge to challenge the results, and specifically in Pennsylvania, where they don't have paper ballots, apparently, for some of the districts.
Thanks, Renee.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting because of the Russian hackers messing with the local ballots. You know, it's just such a crazy, volatile situation. I mean, no one seems to agree with me. I was at this, my friends here in San Francisco gave me a book party the other night, and there was, they were, you know, the Paul Costello works at Stanford Medical School. And so there were a lot of doctors there, and there was a psychiatrist there. And I was, and I used to call political strategists about presidential campaigns, and now I call shrinks because Donald Trump, you know, you just have
to
call
him a clinical narcissist.
Yes, which he got mad at, which was disturbing that he didn't know he was a clinical narcissist. He got mad when I called him that. But anyway, the psychiatrist who was at the party was saying that Trump, what we're watching now is that he's regressing into childhood. And I'm like, oh my gosh, you know, there's going to be some further regression. Although there was this Texas state representative who asked me to stop referring to Donald Trump as a child because he said children are awesome. We shouldn't be comparing Donald Trump to a child. But anyway, this is the long way of getting around to saying I may be an outlier here, but I just think he's going to disappear from the political landscape. And he's going to have a hard time in the business world as well. But, you know, yes, they may start this alt-right channel. But, you know, who is the audience? Like white supremacists and anti-Semites. There are swastika signs showing up at Donald Trump rallies. And I just think that he has alienated everyone. It's like Murder on the Orient Express. Everyone now wants to do away with Donald Trump. He has insulted and belittled everyone in his own party. Can't wait for him to leave. You know, the Democrats, President Obama is making a speech this morning about how Trump is so crazy. So I think it's not like he reminds me of a mad king, one of those mad German kings, you know, who locks himself up in his castle. He's locked up in this penthouse on Fifth Avenue. He's blowing off his advisors. You know, he's not listening to anyone, and he's just sort of going crazy.
So then for those folks who are concerned that the behavior in this election has sort of shifted norms, right, that it's normalized certain repugnant behavior, aggression, misogyny, they don't have to worry because he'll be sent back into his little castle?
Well, of course, you know, there's things have coarsened. I mean, the Donald Trump campaign is a nexus of social media, reality TV, and politics. And things have gotten coarser, but I just think that he has taken things to a level that, you know, the majority of Americans are going to reject as their political discourse.
Shabab writes, I read your column in which you talked about your conservative sister saying she could see Trump as president after the second debate. Can you please talk more about that? So your sister has gone back and forth.
I know. There was this primal scream from Times readers about my sister. But, you know, just days before that, she said Trump needed to be committed to St. Elizabeth's, which is the, you know, D.C. mental institution. So
is she still going to vote for him?
I just think that if you read the essays by my brother and sister, it gives you insight into what Paul Ryan is going through, because they don't want Hillary Clinton as president and they do want a conservative Supreme Court. So then what are they to do? And, you know, she, every time he does something appalling, she jumps off the train and is completely disgusted. But then she doesn't want Hillary Clinton either. And Hillary Clinton's closing line is, I am the only thing standing between you and the apocalypse. But I guess what most Times readers really don't get is, like, my siblings see her as the apocalypse. So they're struggling to figure out what to do. Well, and after the Khan Gold Star thing, my brother Kevin called me and he goes, can you kill my essay in the book, you know, supporting Trump? And I'm like, no, the book is already shipped. And again, he's struggling because he does not want, you know,
so they haven't made a final
another
decision.
President Clinton.
Yeah. Well, speaking of your family, you have said that you've gotten your sensibilities from your dad.
Oh, right. My dad was a Democrat. He was a police detective who was in charge of Senate security for 14 or 15 years. And he, you know, he would decide on politicians more by, like, the kind of person they were. And his favorite was Harry Truman. He stayed up all night the night he was elected. And he, you know, he knew Harry Truman. And Harry Truman was just a really decent person to, you know, the working people at the Capitol. And so, you know, my dad would kind of form opinions that way on the person rather. And it's really hard for Times readers, I know, sometimes to understand that I don't write an ideological column. It doesn't come from the left or the right. It's more like a Shakespeare play where you see how power warps someone or how someone rises to the occasion of having power. And having seen so many presidents become mentally unbalanced in office or all their insecurities come out and we have disasters like the Iraq War, I just think it's, you know, it's good to kind of watch how power is either hurting them or they're rising to the occasion.
And your family became a Republican. I mean, they love JFK, right? But your family became, and you have an Irish Catholic background as well. And
yeah.
You've written about how that was really important to your family in terms of who was representing them. But they all fell in love with Ronald Reagan. Is that right?
Well, after my dad died, my mom fell in love with Ronald Reagan and my sister, who had been at JFK's inauguration and loved him. And then, strangely enough, she moved to California and was there. She was a Bobby Kennedy supporter and was there the night he was assassinated at the Ambassador Hotel. Mm-hmm. But then Reagan became governor out here and she decided she liked him and my mom loved Reagan. So yeah, everybody switched over to being a Republican.
Do you think your mom would have gone for Trump?
You know, I think my mom would have gone for Hillary, actually, because she really thought Hillary was super impressive and she loved women who accomplished a lot. And she talked about how Hillary had accomplished so much. So, and my mom, you know, was very commonsensical and I don't think she would have liked this. I don't think she, you know, she was very patriotic. She would get upset if I wasn't wearing red, white, and blue on July 4th. And I don't think she would associate all of these dark, violent, reprehensible emotions he's stirring up with what's best for America.
Well, let's go to Doug in San Leandro. Hi, Doug.
Hi. Earlier in the broadcast, we hear Maureen Dowd say that Donald Trump was actually right to claim that Hillary Clinton was responsible for the birther movement. But then, a few sentences later, she said, well, they say that her campaign didn't actually forward that that rumor, but whatever. And what I'd like to have like a recognition here is that despite Maureen's claim that she doesn't take her relationships with politicians, national politicians personally, there's a thread of personal animus that runs through the reporting that she does on many political figures, and it seems to me particularly the Clintons. It's apparent in her columns, and it's apparent in the things that she's saying here today, like that she thinks she's
well,
the queen,
well, Doug, let
she
me,
expects a coronation.
Let me give her a chance to respond. Go ahead, Marina.
Yeah, no, you mischaracterized what I said completely. I said that it has come out. I didn't say Donald Trump and the, you know, what he did with the birther movement was reprehensible. And when I went down to have lunch with Bush Sr., who I covered for The New York Times in 2011, I was asking him and he was saying he loved Bill Clinton. He loved Barack Obama. And I brought up Donald Trump because he was, you know, involved in the birther movement at that time. And Bush Sr. said he's an ass. And that was way before he knew that he would be challenging Jeb. So that's one thing. The other thing is that it has come out recently that Sidney Blumenthal went to a reporter at McClatchy and suggested that he send a reporter to Kenya to investigate Obama's birth. So as with many things with Trump, there was a tiny kernel of truth that got distorted. But I did not say what Hillary Clinton's involvement is in this. I'm just saying Sidney Blumenthal is a very close advisor of hers, and he did promote the birther movement, and people from her campaign also called other reporters on it. So that's just true.
Well, Doug, thanks for the question. I mean, ultimately, the responsibility for that, you know, lie reaching the level that it did falls on Donald Trump.
Absolutely.
Pete writes, Trump was always imploding, even from the very beginning. So what the hell is wrong with Republicans who back him? Seriously. And then Joseph asks, how can anyone accusing Trump of groping be taken seriously or even believed this close to the election? How much damage has mainstream media done to their reputation by clearly being in the tank for Hillary?
Well, you know, we've just never seen anything like this. If you turn on Fox, you have Bill Clinton's accusers. And if you turn on any other television station, there's this cascade of Trump accusers. There are going to be more this afternoon. And then Mike Pence was on the Today Show this morning saying Trump has evidence against them and Melania. And, you know, Trump
later, yeah, in the day.
And
supposedly
Trump is, you know, suing the New York Times now. And our lawyer, David McCraw, who's a really cool guy, said, put out a statement, you know, and said, look, you were the one who confessed to groping. We just provided the evidence. And when he walked through the newsroom yesterday, he got a standing ovation.
I was going to ask you about that because I found it interesting that they printed portions of the threat letter from Trump's attorney and then their response, which was the New York Times essentially saying, bring it on, right?
Well, because they said, you already confessed to the crime.
Is that pretty unique, though, for the paper to make that decision?
Well, I just think in this case, you know, Trump tries to use lawsuits to threaten and intimidate. And, you know, David McCraw is not having any of that. He said, look, you already confessed to the crime. We're just giving some of the evidence of what you already confessed to.
All right. Well, let's go now to Laura in Northern Arkansas. Hi, Laura.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a longtime Republican who would have voted this election for Bernie if he had made it. I will be voting for Hillary. Here's my question. Trump managed to just bowl through the rest of the Republican candidates pretty easily. I'm not sure how he did it, but, you know, his own instability, I think, is what's bringing him down. My question is, is there anything that you think future candidates in either party are going to learn from what he did, you know, and I hope it's not going to be one-liners or racist or bigoted comments, but anything going forward that candidates are going to take and think, wow, that's really what I need to do in the future to get the good attention of voters. And if you understand that question, I'll hang up and listen offline.
Laura, thanks. I understand that question. I want to add to it if I could, which is, yes, what does this Republican Party become? Because there's been a lot of talk about whether or not we're witnessing the crack up of the Republican Party, and where does it go with its message?
Yeah, I don't know. You know, I think that, well, to answer yours first, the Republican Party, you know, they did an autopsy last time where, you know, they studied and they came out with this paper and they realized that they couldn't get anywhere if they just had like this nucleus of white male voters. And, you know, so they were going to expand, but then they didn't. They've dug in because of Donald Trump. So, you know, they just keep making the same mistake over and over again, which is their party can't ever get back to the White House if they turn off all the women voters and African-American voters and Latino voters. So they'll just get marginalized. And then what was her question was?
I think it was more about adopting his language.
Oh, right. Well, I mean, if there was some way to emulate his, you know, ability to not spend so much money, not, you know, spend so much money on negative ads or on useless strategists, that would be good. But that probably won't happen. And I think that basically his approach of belittling and insulting everyone and tearing, you know, it's like he's in a sinkhole and he's trying to drag everyone down with him and bringing Bill's accusers to the debate and putting them in the front row. We wanted to put them in the family box, is so toxic that people will be able to see in real time that this, you know, is not going to get you anywhere but imploding. So it started with Don Rickles' lines and it's ending up with this massive, you know, psychological meltdown. So I don't think anyone's going to want to emulate his style in the future.
Well, here's a question from Scott. He writes, is Dowd going to apologize or does she have any second thoughts about her derisive columns about Obama, President Obama, or as she snarkily calls him, Barry?
Oh, well,
what do
I
you think of President
yeah,
Obama?
No, I have called him Barry a few times, but that was to explain a different aspect of his personality. It's more, it wasn't meant to diminish. It was meant to, for instance, like Henry IV and Prince Hal, where Barack Obama is the magisterial, magical speechmaker who can go to Argentina and do an amazing tango. And then Barry is kind of the policy wonk who stays up to 1 a.m. studying briefing papers and he wears mom jeans and, you know, eats 7 lightly salted almonds a night. He's very disciplined. So it was more just showing different sides of him. I didn't mean it to be offensive. I called W.W. all through his presidency. I call Hillary Hillary. I called Rumsfeld Rummy. I mean, I have tended to use nicknames only in a Shakespearean way to make it to make the cast of characters a little more familiar.
I'm going to allow this one last criticism about Hillary Clinton again, just because I think that's something that's really on a lot of our listeners' minds, clearly. Jerry writes, I used to enjoy reading Dowd's column in the New York Times, but her blaming and castigating Hillary Clinton for Bill's indiscretions was unacceptable and beyond comprehension. It was wrong and a sexist thing to say, and she should be ashamed of that and should apologize for it. I want to ask you, after, you know, reading that comment, I'm just curious if you think she'll be a good president. If you are giving the election to her, as you said from the very beginning of our conversation, do you think she'll be a good president?
Well, I want to address his comment first, which is I don't hold her responsible for him being unfaithful. I hold her responsible for being involved in smearing the reputations of some of the women who truthfully said they were involved with him. That's true. I do hold her responsible for that. But in the introduction, I quote Harry Truman saying that you never know how a man in those days, will take the responsibility of being president. And having watched, you know, having covered 9 campaigns and watched people become president, I think that's really true, because you never know what historical event like 9/11 might happen. You never know what insecurities and gremlins might come out. And we watched this with W, who said he would have a humble foreign policy. And then he made the biggest foreign policy mistake in modern history. So it's just very hard to tell, you know, how these things will intersect, how mm-hmm. someone will take that responsibility. And with Hillary, you know, I think if she keeps the paranoid defensive side at bay and focuses on the idealistic public servant side, she'll do very well. But we don't know, you know, if she will get more paranoid and secretive, or if she will get confident and drop these, you know, kind of seamy henchmen she has. It's hard to tell how it will play out.
We have just a minute left. You've covered 9 presidential elections. I'm just curious how you sum up this one, you know, relative to the ones you've covered all this time.
I would say that this is by far, you know, the darkest and the most crazy and
ever that you've ever covered.
Oh, definitely. It's just on an exponential level beyond.
And your hope once we come out of this?
I mean, as I say, I just think he's going to be like a orange fiery comet going into the ocean, I hope.
Well, Maureen Dowd of the New York Times, Pulitzer Prize winning columnist and author of the new book, The Year of Voting Dangerously, all about the 2016 presidential election. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much, Mina.
And thank you to our listeners for their questions. Forum is produced by Irene Noguchi, Tina Lauerberg, Judy Campbell. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. And we get online support from Amanda Font. Our interns are Maxine Schofer-Wolf and Brandon Yu. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. And Joanne Wallace is our executive producer. I'm Mina Kim. You're listening to Forum. Stay with us.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegas Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.